are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, September 5th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks. This is a Michael Thursday. And this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Ronan Burtonshaw. He's the editor of the Tribune in the United Kingdom, talking about why only Corbynism is the way out of the UK crisis, how one of the most dynamic and interesting center-left social democratic parties in the world, which the Labour Party is under the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, could take the UK out of its Boris Johnson clown show, clown fascist show. We'll talk about that. New watchdog further details the severe trauma of children who have been kidnapped and separated from their families by the Trump administration's policies. Horrible, disgusting stuff. Even as new documents reveal that the FBI is tracking border groups, protest border organizations, as extremists, because it's apparently extreme to oppose kidnapping children and detaining refugees. 20 people have died in the Bahamas as Hurricane Dorian goes back to a Category 3 and threatens the Carolinas. I don't have many good things to say about House Democratic Caucus Chair Hakeem Jeffries. However, he has become the highest-ranking Democrat to co-sponsor Medicare for All. And significant because I think Jeffries' path that he sees is Speaker of the House, not necessarily a run for higher office. So it's a different type of calculation than someone like a Kamala Harris, who will backtrack on that type of thing when she runs for president. Pentagon pulls funds from military schools and daycare to pay for Trump's border wall. That's a great way to support the troops. Chief U.S. Asylum Office resigns as White House pushes for even tighter controls on immigration. And defiance, uprising, and anger as the Indian crackdown in Kashmir continues, detaining people, boys as young as 12 years old, and the communication blackout continues after the BJP government tore the Indian constitution over a month ago. Iran lifts more limits on its nuclear program as the Trump calamity continues on the Iran deal. The Taliban claim a deadly attack near a U.S. embassy in Kabul. And China and the United States set to resume trade talks in October as the Trump administration reverses standards for energy-efficient light bulbs. I mean, who wants to deal with that? All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, everybody. Welcome, folks. Of course, there was also a big climate forum last night on CNN. Shouts to the success of the grassroots organizing of the Sunrise Movement. Well done. Bernie Sanders was incredible. Elizabeth Warren was very good and also not so good. Joe Biden bled. And
shouts to the failure of Joe Biden's eye blood vessels.
Joe Biden's
very...
And his scheduling team.
And his scheduling team. Joe Biden bled from the eye and then scooted off today to a fundraiser with a fossil fuel executive. And Kamala Harris gift-wrapped with a bow the most insignificant environmental intervention imaginable and a beautiful gift to the right-wing noise machine. And I don't really know what anybody else had to say. If I'm being 100% honest, I had heard that Andrew Yang made some claim about the Green New Deal getting rid of air travel or something.
Trash.
Which was not
Yang's
good.
Trash, folks.
Not good.
If you like Andrew Yang, you overrate your ability to parse policy. and are probably too invested in one specific policy that you want to like pay for your video games. No, I'm sympathetic too, but come on, guys.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, Matt represents that demographic on this program.
I'm the next level of you, so just follow the show. And
what do you think is the Venn diagram between callers who said you could set up PC gaming systems for Bitcoin mining and UBI fans?
100%.
100%.
A circle.
Yeah. Do you remember that? What was so wild about that Bitcoin rigging stuff was that in addition to it not being a sound economic strategy was that it was basically like it was hugely environmentally harmful. I don't remember the stats, well, but a Bitcoin rig, the amount of energy that it took when they extrapolated it, this was a couple years ago, but it was some type of like stunning contribution to greenhouse gas emissions.
Because so the way you mine, and I've never done hot air. But you get like the top of the line computer graphics card, and that's what runs it. So it's just like massive amount of wattage to power these calculations. But it did help the consumer graphics card market. So shouts out to all the Bitcoiners out there for subsidizing that technology.
So it did have some strong economic impact. Donald Trump didn't know what a Category 5 is. You know, whatever. Donald Trump's an idiot. I mean, some of them are funny. The thing that's weird about Trump is that the only time it's like there's three grids. There's actually keeping track of Trump and the Republican Party as the greatest threat to the survival of the human species, which we kind of all have to do. Then there's occasionally, and we're about to basically play something that is so dumb that it still actually crosses the bar. It is kind of funny. And then the other times he says stuff that is legitimately hilarious. And then pretty much everything else, like, I'm on team, mostly ignore the guy. Like, just stop freaking out about everything he says and does, frankly. But here is particularly everything he says or tweets, I should say. But here, Donald Trump is, he made an ass of himself about the hurricane last week. He has no fucking clue what's going on. Excuse my language. And here he is in the White House saving face with a Sharpie.
We got lucky in Florida, very, very lucky indeed. We had actually our original chart was that it was going to be hitting Florida directly. Maybe I could just see that, Kevin. It was going
totally
to be hitting
control.
Directly.
First time I'm seeing
it would have affected
chart.
A lot of other states.
A lot of
that
other
was
states.
The original chart. And you see it was going to hit not only Florida, but Georgia. It could have was going toward the Gulf. That was what was originally projected. I know that Alabama was in the original forecast. They thought it would get it as a piece of it. It was supposed to go. Actually, we have a better map than that, which is going to be presented where we had many lines going directly, many models, each line being a model. The original path that most people thought it was going to be taking, as you know, was right through Florida, where on the right would have been Georgia, Alabama, et cetera.
Et cetera. Et cetera.
That map that you showed today looked like it almost had like a Sharpie.
I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know.
We had a lot of models.
I don't know. A lot of offers. A lot of options.
I don't know where all the models came from, but we have the best models, folks. Trust me. I know how to pick a model.
I owned a modeling agency, folks.
Oh, my God. All right. As you know, Sam Cedar loves to read ads. So let's indulge in his great pleasure and watch some Sam Cedar advertisements. And then I will come back with an interview with Ronan Burton Shaw on Corbynism and the crisis in the UK.
Thank you, Michael. I just want to remind folks that support for today's show comes from Third Love. With more than 70 sizes, including their signature half cup sizes, Third Love designed bras with breast size and shape in mind for a perfect fit and a premium feel. I, of course, do not wear a bra. Maybe not, of course, but I don't wear a bra in the normal course of my daily existence. However, we do have one of our expert bra wearers who tried out a couple of Third Love bras. Here's what she said. I like that they don't have a zillion options, so it's easy to choose something quickly. The fit is great. I usually have to return most bras I order online, even though they're in my size. I ordered two. Both fit. That almost never happens. Super comfortable for an everyday bra, but not as boring as most t-shirt bras. Subtle, cute details, so I don't feel basic. There you go, folks. This is hands down the most comfortable bra you'll own. Straps that don't slip, tagless labels, not to mention lightweight, super thin memory foam cups that mold to your shape and are proprietary to Third Love. Best of all, every customer has 60 days to wear it, wash it, put it to the test. And if you don't love it, you can return it, and Third Love will wash and donate it to a woman in need. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now. Find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off today. Those are good bras. I have like extended family wearing Third Love bras. They're good bras. Everybody comes back with something good. Meanwhile, support for today's show also comes from Mova Globes. Mova Globes turn all on their own. Check this out, Matt. Have you seen this? So I told Saul that I got it for him, but he wants to, I have to show it for when we advertise for it. And he's like, why? And I'm like, well, I mean, cause that's how I got the globe.
I want one of those.
It's super cool. They turn all on their own with or without the base. This is my little base I got right here. In any SAM setting with ambient lighting, no batteries are needed, no sloppy cords to detract from your enjoyment. Instead, hidden magnets provide all the movement. It's super cool. With over 40 different designs, including world maps, outer space, famous artworks, there's something for everyone. I may get the outer space collection. It features graphic provided by NASA and JPL. What's JPL?
I don't know.
I know what NASA is. It's complete with planets, moons, asteroids, constellation designs.
It's the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Yeah, that's the one I think I'm going to get next. I mean, these things, they're like collector's items, and they're beautiful. It's a great gift for the person who has everything. Or you can, use it as like home decor. I don't know. I've always been a big globe guy. I like to find older ones that have countries that don't exist anymore or older ones. But this is really amazing. And this one gives you like the air flows, I imagine, until climate change destroys everything. And then they would come out with a new one.
Be nice to remember what it was like.
But it's beautiful and it's super cool. And it sort of functions like a compass. Like it's always facing north, I guess.
Yeah, it's very interesting looking.
Yeah, and it's, I love it. They have ones that have vintage maps. There's one like that one from 1790, a vintage map that has no Antarctica because they hadn't discovered it yet. It's cool. Mova Globes, folks. Visit www.movaglobes.com/majority. Use the code majority for 10% off your purchase. That's Mova, M-O-V-A, globes.com/majority. Use the code majority for 10% off your purchase. You know, one of the things that I've always known about, and we don't really talk about it that much anymore. Maybe it was more important to society when we were engaged in, you know, full-scale wars, that people had a sense of where things were on the globe. But this is a great gift. I mean, I guess I'm a little bit child-centric, but it's a great gift for your kids or your teenagers. Just give them a sense of the planet and also space. That's movaglobes.com/majority. Use the code majority, get 10% off. And lastly, so I don't know if people have noticed it, but, you know, following my divorce, I tried to pick up my fashion game a little. Like, I only have so much. There's only so much I can do. All right. But I have. And but on top of that, as I was sort of searching around, I heard about this company, Everlane, and super psyched to say that they are advertising with the show now. And one of the amazing things about this, not only is it sort of like the, it's not like high style, but it's like comfortable. It's perfect. It's perfect for me. But the fascinating thing about this company is they make, you know, premium essential clothing, t-shirts, pants, Oxford shirts, shoes, sneakers. I've got some very nice, like now, like adult sneakers, essentially. But they use top quality materials, but they don't have the traditional markups. And they're incredibly transparent with their pricing. In fact, I would say they're radically transparent. They tell every part of their cost, every part of the process, how much it costs, the ethical factories they work in. And so these clothes look better. They last longer. They cost less. You even have the opportunity to sort of pick your own price. It's nuts. I have a bunch of different things that I've tried from them. I have, you know, of course, I got the sort of the hoodie, the sweatshirts, the soft, what do you call it? The fleece hoodie. Incredibly comfortable. That came in, sadly, on my vacation. It rained quite a bit at the beach when I was there, but I was determined to go out. And so I had my fleece hoodie. I have a beautiful all-weather jacket that is light and perfect for me because whenever I go to the beach, it rains. And I also have I got like a canvassy, I think they call it Twill Weekender bag, which is, you know, I finally look like an adult now. I don't travel with like a garbage bag or, you know, one of those open-ended IKEA blue bags. I actually have like an adult bag now. And I also got a pair of like I said, the sneakers in Raven color. I think they have different colors now, but Everlane, it's, they have all sorts of different, like, and for women's, they have shoes, they have Japanese denim, they have these perfectly fitting Oxfords. Right now, you can check out our personalized collection at everlane.com/majority. Plus, you're going to get free shipping on your first order. That's everlane.com/majority, everlane.com/majority, spelled E-V-E-R, ever, lane, L-A-N-E, .com/majority. All right, quick break. Michael will be right back after this.
Well, I don't know about you folks, but I certainly feel extremely educated on those products. Like, highly informed. You buy two Mauve Globes and you put them in one third love bra. Shouts to the best YouTube comment
Mova
ever.
Globe.
Two Mova Globes. Mova Globes?
Mova.
Mova. Whew. Those are great bras. I was on the beach and we were walking and then someone said, those are great bras. And I said, that's a great globe too. Let's leave the beach before we get sunburned so we can order from Everlane. 10 more minutes? All right, folks.
We're going to become a member.
We're going to take it. Yes, become a member. Become a member. We're going to take a brief break. Brief break, and we will come back with Roden Burtonshaw to discuss Corbynism and what's happening in the UK.
The rain, the truncheon thing, the ice is coming. The sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected. The wheat is going thin. Engines stop running. But I have no fear. Cause London is drowning. Draw another breath. London calling. And I don't want to shout, but while we were talking I saw you nodding out. London calling. See, we ain't got no hide except for that one.
Welcome back. For people listening on podcast, you really just got to enjoy a legit classic. Joining us now on the Majority Report is Ronan Burtonshaw. He is the editor of the Tribune, and he's also author recently of a piece in the Jackman magazine, Only Corbynism Can Defeat Boris. Ronan, thanks so much for being here.
Delighted to be on with you.
So before we get into why Corbynism is the path forward, what's the state of play? I mean, we do a lot of jokes on this show, like the latest news is that, you know, at not 0.4 100 hours, the Queen will wink at Boris Johnson. If he does not wink back, then there'll be an early election. You know, my point being, there's a lot of machinations. There's a lot of different bureaucratic hurdles. The fact that the UK does not have a written constitution, I think, might be playing a role in all of this. Boris Johnson is still prime minister, but he does not have a majority. What's actually going on? What is the state of play we're in? Are we headed to elections? Give us a kind of lay of the land.
Eventually, we will get to a general election. The question of how we get there is pretty complicated. Obviously, there's been a lot of parliamentary machinations over the last few days. I don't think it's a great terrain for socialists, to be honest, because it's a kind of disempowering thing, right? Where people are reduced to being spectators to this drama that's going on in Westminster. Westminster, of course, being deeply unpopular as well as everything else with the mass of the population. What's going on at the moment is basically this battle over whether Parliament can stop a no deal. So Boris Johnson lost two big votes in the last couple of days over whether he can push through a no deal Brexit. Parliament, both obviously the vast majority of Labour MPs, in addition to the Lib Dems, the Green MP and a number of Tory rebels, voted against him, which meant that he lost decisively by 25 or so votes twice. Over that question, he then responded by putting a what's called a Fixed Term Parliament Act motion down. This Fixed Term Parliament Act, which was agreed under David Cameron's government, complicates everything further, because in the past it used to be the case in the House of Commons that when a government would be losing votes on significant issues, the government would fall and there would have to be an election. In a kind of fit of liberal pique, Cameron and the Lib Dems introduced a piece of legislation that said, oh, this is just too inappropriate a way for our governments to fall. And so instead, we need some kind of more rational decision making where we'd only get an election when the parliament actually voted for it. But of course, that leaves the completely ridiculous scenario where a government can have no majority, lose its first four votes under a new prime minister, and still there be no election. So you can go on with this kind of zombie government for a very, very long time because of this piece of legislation that, like so much of the rationalism liberals try to impose on politics, doesn't actually work when it meets reality. Right. So this is one of the reasons we're stuck in this situation. I happen to think it's a complicated one for Labour too. Obviously, there's been a lot of upbeat commentary from parts of the left over recent days because you've got a new prime minister in who's being defeated in Parliament. So things look good for Corbyn. It's a very complicated position for Labour to be in because Labour, having for 2 years demanded an immediate general election, has just basically turned up the opportunity of doing an election. And the stated reason for that is, well, we don't want to vote for an election because it would be possible for Boris Johnson to simply wait out the clock on a no deal Brexit using this using the election. So he would be able, of course, to set the time, which would mean that a no-deal Brexit could happen. And so the Labour Party is insisting that this piece of legislation that's been passed against a no-deal has to go through, get the Queen's assent and be put into place before any such election happens. Boris Johnson is taking advantage of that to claim that Labour is running away from an election, and he's up in Wakefield today doing a pretty incredible beginning, I think, of an election campaign, effectively. That's what today is, where he's about to make a speech in front of a backdrop of uniformed police laying into Jeremy Corbyn. And this is what we're going to find in the election once it comes. It's going to be white knuckle. Boris Johnson and his team are going to try to run a populist campaign. Mm-hmm. Their desired framing of the entire election is the Parliament versus the people. The people want Brexit, and the Parliament and the political establishment is denying them. Brexit is a cabal frustrating the popular will, and it's a dangerous terrain for Labour to be on. And I think it's increasingly important that Labour comes out fighting hard from the left in the coming days to prevent Boris Johnson from being able to present himself as the champion of the people against the political establishment.
Let's talk a little bit about Boris Johnson and then get to what would be a good terrain for socialists and how that leads to what Labour can do. And maybe also the delusions and dangers of the Liberal Democrats. As I always say, friends don't let friends vote Liberal Democrat. But Boris Johnson built his whole brand and he's very different than Trump, obviously. A lot of the kind of superficial comparisons actually don't really work. He's a lifelong – well, not a lifelong, but he's a veteran politician. He's mayor of London. He's not sort of completely coming out of nowhere as an elected official. But they both are, you know, they both have these hard right, not populist in the proper understanding of the word, but they're both television candidates. Boris Johnson built his whole brand as sort of playing this kind of ridiculous, foppish kind of character on UK TV, sort of, you know, forgetting where his keys are, kind of bumbling rich guy sort of thing. As prime minister so far, it's actually really seemed to me, at least presentationally, to not work. That his whole brand was built on an ability to be kind of entertaining and rebellious in really relatively easy television and public speaking gigs. And now when he's got protesters shouting him down, when he's got a parliament defying him every step of the way, he looks smaller and smaller in that role, and I could see why he wants to get back on an election footing as quickly as possible. But what's your sort of read of the Boris Johnson personality? Maybe you could also explain to people who Dominic Cummings is, who's his sort of political Svengali, who's sort of creating so much agitation there as well.
Yeah, so Boris Johnson, I mean, I agree with your characterization of him. He is a mediatic figure. He's one of these new 21st century political animals who has very much built his persona outside of the political system, even as he has served as a politician. You know, he is not renowned across the country predominantly because of what he did as mayor and whatever else. He's renowned because of the persona that he created around himself by appearing on things like comedy shows, Have I Got News For You on the BBC and so on. And that for today is a smart way to develop a political career. I agree as well that he's not been able to use the kind of parliamentary structures as well as he would have wanted. His PMQs, as they're called over here, his Prime Minister's Questions, which many people expected because of his supposed rhetorical abilities, he would use to you know, defeat Corbyn resoundingly, has actually not worked that way at all. I would say yesterday, Jeremy Corbyn was far more impressive a performer at the dispatch box than Boris Johnson was. The problem, though, is that I think he's trying to make an adjustment at the moment, led by Dominic Cummings and his team of advisors, which is away from some of the foppish stuff, but towards somebody who better suits, and I know this is a loose term, but that kind of populist framing. And the important thing to understand with populism in this case is, I think populism can be put forward as a way of doing politics in which, you know, the primary oratorical tool is defining the enemy. And in this case, and saying, you know, you've got the people against this enemy, this is actually quite a good way of understanding and seeing populism as it's used at the moment. This is what Boris Johnson there wants to do. He wants to say, we've got the people who voted for Brexit against the enemy, which is the parliament, the political establishment, the media establishment, and so on. It's a smart framing. I think it's a potentially useful framing for him. And so what they want to do is refit his persona to make into that space. And in the early stages, you know, you started getting things like he would throw out a line in a speech that, you know, he wanted people to fixate on and discuss and debate instead of some of the more, you know, politically tricky and complex parts of it. So in his opening speech as prime minister, he, you know, referred to the country as dudes and so on. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking to himself, well, why is he doing this? Well, actually, the reason he's doing it, I think, is straightforward enough that when you looked at the headlines of all the papers the next day, particularly the right-wing ones, he picked up that term as a way of bringing people in to read about what was in the speech, because it's an interesting left field, so on, bizarre framing to use. And there's this thing which has often been talked about in terms of Cummings' idea of how you do political communication. And it's actually, I think it comes from, in the first instance, it comes from Linton Crosby, which is the dead cat analogy, right? Which is, if things are not going well for you and everyone's talking about an issue you don't want them to talk about, and then you take out a dead cat and you throw it on the table, and all of a sudden everyone's asking, why is there a dead cat on the table instead of what they were talking about beforehand? And this is something Boris Johnson uses and uses quite well. In terms of, you know, the way in which he wants to put himself forward, as I've just said, today's speech, I think, is a perfect way of exemplifying that. The way his coalition makes sense, that this Brexit coalition requires a fundamental realignment of British politics. His camp feel that it's already underway and, in fact, not pretty unstoppable. Along the Brexit versus Remain lines. And so he's going up to the north of England today to speak in a traditional working class area in Wakefield, in which he is flanked by police officers talking about law and order, putting more bobbies on the beat, those kind of culture war issues, where he feels he can break away a part of Labour's base in the north of England, who may have an interest, economically speaking, in voting for the Labour Party, but who are much more conservative on social issues. And
another thing that he's doing, I've noticed, and this is actually very different than Trump, and maybe more analogous actually to some of the things that someone like Marine Le Pen would put forward in France, at least superficially, is he's been bragging a lot that his first budget, and I think this is the you know, centering in on the chunk of labor he wants to break off. He's got the anti-immigrant, xenophobia, Brexit stuff, but then he is promising the highest investment levels in public services, not even before the, you know, immense austerity that's just been pounding the UK under Cameron and Clegg and then May. So that's like 10 years. But actually going back to 2002, I saw him last night, I think, on Sky bragging that his budget matches the first, second term Blair budget, where, in fact, the Blair government did significantly increase spending on the NHS and education. That's what Boris is putting forward too. So he's making that play. And unlike a Trump, where there's a lot of rhetoric about some sort of economic stuff, but it's all just been doctrine, Republican policies, pretty much 99%. Even some of the tariff stuff actually has deeper roots in Republican policies. Boris seems to be putting forward at least some talking points that he could say, hey, I'm actually, you know, ending austerity.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's very important with all these things, with these kind of right-wing populist figures, you look under the hood.
Yep.
Because on the NHS commitments, for instance, this is one of his big areas, right, that he wants to break from conservative orthodoxy, is to say we will be a government that invests in the NHS, because it is the most popular issue in the entirety of British politics. And it's one that, without any doubt, wins you votes in traditional working class areas. So he made this commitment to a great increase in NHS spending. But actually, when you looked under the hood of it, almost the entirety of the money that he was pledging to put forward had already been committed in various ways. So he was just moving the money around rather than putting forward new investments. This will be what he does. And also, yesterday's spending review was a part of that. And it's very important to this point about it, I think, is very important. He put in place a spending review where he got to foreground a lot of these new policy announcements. But he did it in such a way that the Office for Budgetary Review and Statistics was not able to assess beforehand the impact of these commitments. So usually when a spending review comes out, the official body looks over the commitments that are being made, puts them in the context of previous commitments, where the money is coming from, says what the impact is likely to be on the deficit and so on, you know, all of those kind of things. That didn't happen. So he did it in a way, because of the Brexit crisis, that he could make all these announcements and it not be costed, it not be put in context of previous governments. Again, it's smart, but it is part of a much broader change that Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings want to make to British politics, which is that they basically want to throw out the conventions and the norms.
And Dominic Cummings, just so people know, is a very – and you always got to be very careful with these figures, in my view, because they're incredible self-promoters. There's a lot of BS. There's a lot of nonsense. However, unlike a Steve Bannon, who – primarily seems like his primary talent seems to be in getting, you know, very disturbed rich people who have bank accounts to buy into his, you know, his horrific vision. Dominic Cummings is somebody who has he was the political head of communications for the Brexit campaign. That's a significant win. He is somebody who, again, if you read his blogs, and I've tried to read his blogs, there's a lot of techno gobbledygook. There's a lot of, maybe if I throw an Aristotle quote in here, it will seem more, you know, I'll be making a statement that sounds significantly more important than it is or more profound than it is. But that being said, unlike some of these other kind of self-promoting sort of Svengali wannabe characters, he does have actual political success behind him. He does have a capacity to operate, and that's an important distinction.
I would agree. I mean, Dominic Cummings is one of these guys, right, who very much fits into the Silicon Valley ideology with all of its contradictions. And yes, it's self-promotion, but also a degree of basis in empiricism. And the thing that I think makes Cummings an interesting and threatening opponent for us, without overemphasizing, right, the degree to which he can shift the political terrain, is that when, after the Vote Leave campaign, he was going around the country giving various speeches, and one of the most interesting ones which came up on YouTube was when he was speaking to a group of computer scientists, and he was talking about people's ideas of polling and politics. And he was saying the thing that the political center gets wrong is they believe that the middle ground of politics is some kind of balance between the right and the left. So, you know, if you're a moderate, so to speak, of the Tories, or a moderate of the Labour, you represent the center ground. And he said that's completely wrong. The center ground, if you look at polling in politics, is somewhere between left-wing economics and right-wing social conservatism.
So he gets it.
that is unfortunately a much more astute understanding of how politics works, that the political system doesn't really represent the popular opinion. It never has. The middle ground in Westminster has little to do with the middle ground of the population. But that particular understanding of, like, the fact that the vast majority of people in Britain would simultaneously vote for huge redistribution of wealth from the rich, would vote for increase in spending in public services, would vote for nationalizations, there's no doubt about it, but also would, you know, quite possibly vote for the reintroduction of capital punishments and so forth, right? And this is something he gets, and that does make him dangerous. And I know a lot of people talk about not wanting to overemphasize the roles of these figures, but when you have somebody with that understanding, then you get what we're seeing now with Boris Johnson, which is announcements on the economy, which sound a lot more left wing than what the Tories have traditionally done, and are trying consciously to take away what Labour's strength was in the 2017 election, when the Tories came out with their kind of death tax proposals, right? Not in the American sense, but this social care thing, where they talked about people having to pay exorbitant amounts for elderly people to get access to social care, and it just went down like a lead balloon, and they had to walk away from it. And it has been a consistent weakness of the Tories for a long time, that they're considered to be against popular public services, against investment, against taxing the rich, a kind of elite project representing the class interests of the millionaires and so on, even as they were considered to be more capable and sensible stewards of the economy than Labour. This is all now flipped, and it's very important that we come up with a way of doing Labour politics in the new environment, where the Tories are now, you know, by any mainstream economist's view, in terms of no deal Brexit, driving the economy off a cliff. So they can no longer be seen as the sensible stewards of the economy. They've conceded one of the big ideological weapons they used to have against the left, that, you know, the left will bankrupt you, but we're going to, run the economy well. But at the same time, they've picked up some of our clothes, which is they've started talking about investment in public services and supporting the NHS and all this, much as we all know they won't do it.
I want to get to Corbynism and the socialist opportunity in a minute. And maybe the thread to get there is that even as we have this, in some ways, I mean, I don't want to overemphasize it either. I mean, this has been really shambolic, and there's been a huge amount of failure in the last couple of days. And even Dominique Cummings had a kind of unflattering article written about him that supposedly they thought he was just some random drunk guy in Parliament. And he went up slurring his words to Corbyn saying, "How about we have an election? Come on." And, you know, I don't know. So, you know, I want to, as always, sort of balance the significance of the threat and the strategic insight that they represent, and the fact that, in fact, it isn't going that well, at least as of this moment. Mm-hmm. But then we have this resurgent centrist delusion, of the Lib Dems, who should have lost all of their credibility after being in coalition with the Tories in the first Cameron term. And they are representing, you know, they are the politics of the cable news green room, basically. Yes. And obviously it's better. Obviously we're not talking about the same types of racist and xenophobic appeals, though, as always, I would check under the hood with centrists as well, because, you know, going back to the Blair government, at least in the UK, David Blunkett, who was Tony Blair's home minister, talked about dumping, he used with the phrase, with regards to migrants to the UK. And Bill Clinton in the United States signed some of the most vicious immigration policies imaginable. And Obama certainly did not rein in ICE. Now, as I always say, what Trump and people like Boris Johnson and Trump represent is a different order of magnitude. However, it would be delusional and wrong to let centrist politicians present themselves as being socially tolerant and open. That is a real give and take in terms of what is actually there and the merits of their policies. But we have this kind of we have the Lib Dem cable news, you know, banker coalition, which is we should have some, you know, we should have, you know, city bike programs. We shouldn't be mean to gay people. And then we should continue austerity and not have Brexit. What is, you know, that dimension emerging right now as well?
Well, when you talk about the hypocrisies of it, actually, it was a very good example of all the madness of the recent days, which was Philip Lee, a Tory MP, who is a Remainer, quit the Tory party in the middle of the vote over no deal Brexit to join the Lib Dems. But Philip Lee had also, when the Tories were last in government, suggested that migrants coming into the country should be screened for hepatitis and HIV before they were allowed in.
Exactly.
And
right.
voted against gay marriage. And he's now a Liberal. So, you know, these are the limits, I'm afraid, of the of this centering all of politics around the question of Brexit, as you end up in bed with some real monsters. But yeah, there is a resurgence, and it's difficult because, look, what's happening with Brexit in Britain is a part of a phenomenon that's going on internationally, which is that in the absence of left-wing governments, and of governments that can really deal with the underlying economic frustration by redistribution, by empowerment and so on, you're getting realignments of politics that are cutting across class basis on the grounds. In Brexit, obviously, it's Remain versus Leave, but really it's things like the big cities, cosmopolitanism, younger voters, people who are more so-called open to globalization and so on, versus larger towns, smaller cities, regionally deprived areas, places that have lost out from globalization. And this realignment is very complicated for all of us on the left, because I think in the longer term, it looks more like reshaping politics in countries like Britain, which have a historic left-right divide with a strong labor movement and so on, around debates that are more similar to where you guys were, at least for a long time in the States, liberal versus conservative, marching together to the beat of Wall Street, right? Yep. And I don't think that is to our benefit. And so there's been a great attempt by the Corbyn project to try to hold back the tide of that realignment of British politics. I don't think it has been successful, unfortunately, and that leaves us in a difficult position, because it's not to say that there are no left-right questions obviously involved in the Brexit debate, but if you're putting together a coalition, for instance, to try to reshape British politics, break with the legacy of Thatcherism and rebuild a kind of socialist project in Britain, and you're doing it without the votes of millions of people in the north of England and Wales, particularly, who were the ones to lose out most profoundly from Thatcher's reorganization of the economy in post-industrial areas, in the most deprived areas of the country with the worst public services, the highest levels of unemployment, so on. That becomes a very difficult coalition. So you're relying more on socially progressive people in the more affluent parts of the country than you are on people who really can be described as left behind.
In fact, Corbyn's own district is quite socially progressive, affluent. I mean, fortunately, also yes. on board with his much broader vision as well. So they're voting well. But I mean, that's really underlines the point. He doesn't represent the North or a blue collar district. He represents quite a affluent.
Yes and no. And this is the complication.
Yes and no. Okay, tell me.
So the other side of Islington is that Islington does have a lot of deprivation. I mean, obviously, I live in London at the moment, and it's These are the difficulties of it. Yes, London is a very affluent city. Property prices are extraordinarily high. And if you're in that bracket who owns property in this city, you're doing exceptionally well. Wages are much higher than the rest of the country and so on. But then the flip side of that is if you're living in this city and you don't have a high paying job and you don't have wealth independently, well, then the development of the London economy right. over the last 20, 30 years has really screwed you. And so you get... Sure. very high levels of social deprivation, even in pockets that when you look at on average, Islington, where Corbyn represents, is a wealthy area. But then huge proportions of people who are doing very badly, can't afford the rent, in low paid work, in 0 hour contracts, you know, dealing with cuts in benefits and social services. And so you've got both. And this
and
is
that's
the, real-
the pattern. I mean, that's yes, it. That's everywhere. That's New York. That's San Francisco. That's London. That's this way of doing capitalism. And that's what, you know, to the real serious credit of Jeremy Corbyn and the leadership of the current Labour Party, they're actually centering. And of course, Bernie Sanders here, there's great momentum of Bernie Sanders centering that here. But what, I mean, I get all of the, you know, I mean, the dangers are great. The ominous signs are clear from a Tory party that under, you know, Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings actually understand where the electorate's at. That's dangerous. Then we have the resurgence of the neoliberal delusion of the Lib Dems. But what is the opportunity for socialism? And in your words, why can, or in your great article, and I know editors do title these things, but why is Corbynism still the path here? What does it offer and what's the potential positive scenario here from a perspective of redistribution, social openness, and labor power?
Well, we have laid out most of what Boris Johnson wants to do. And it's very important that we say wants to do, because, of course, what we've just discussed is his vision of what an election is, whether he can take this Tory party of, you know, aged millionaires who right. have spent their entire lives in the pockets of the filthiest financial interests in this country and turn them into a gang of populists remains to be seen. But this is what he wants to do. And then the question is, how do you defeat him? And there are pretty much two paths on the table. The first, which is the path that I think is a mistake, but is the one that the majority of the left of centre interests want the Labour Party to go down, the likes of The Guardian, I would say even The Mirror at this stage, is that you kind of coalesce, I would say congeal, around the Liberal centre, and you try to put together an argument against Boris Johnson that presents him as, you know, un-British, as disrespecting these, you know, hallowed institutions.
They're learning from the amazing success of the Clinton campaign and against Donald Trump, basically.
I think there's a huge amount of similarities there. People who have a nostalgia. I mean, in Britain, it's the kind of nostalgia for Britain at the time of the 2012 Olympics, when everything was good and moderate and sensible, and we were proud of the country, whereas actually that was smack bang in the middle of some of the most devastating austerity for huge parts of this country. So you have this kind of idea, which is we're going to go in on a broad alliance with the political centre against Boris Johnson, and we will put forward the idea that we're upholding democratic norms, we're upholding the value of parliament, we're upholding moderate, sensible politics against this Yahoo. And that, in my view, will lose, because I've seen it play out in so many countries. Now, you know, there are always the exception. There's the exception of France, where you are literally against a post-fascist party, and Macron managed to get himself over the line, right. but then has been ludicrously unpopular in office. But most other examples that we've seen, this strategy has failed. And it fails for a reason, which is it's all well and good to defend the status quo, or in this case, status quo ante of just a few years ago, at a time when you've got a majority of people who are, broadly speaking, happy with the direction of the economy, who have access, they feel, to some degree of prosperity in the next 5 or 10 years, whose aspirations for their lives can be met by the kind of economic model, or at least they feel it can. When you've got a country where 60-70% of people think everything is going the wrong way, the economy is getting worse, jobs are getting worse, wages are stagnating, the political system doesn't respond to me, you know, this country feels like I don't have a stake in it anymore, well, then it's very, very hard to win elections trying to rally around the flag of moderation. So I think that the Labour Party has pretty quickly to get itself on a footing where it tries to take Boris Johnson on from the left. And I think that that is the way to expose the kind of weakness of his populism that I just outlined, that actually he's trying to be a populist defending the people against the political establishment when he represents the party of the political establishment for centuries in this country, where the vast majority of his MPs are extremely wealthy, privately educated, landlords who have interests in the very most predatory aspects of British capitalism, who are totally divorced from the day-to-day lives of working people in this country, and that you try to put pressure on his populist project and make it break apart by attacking it from the left, by going at some of these things where he's going to be forced to defend parts of his coalition in the same way that we would, for instance, if they came after the trade unions. Right. Well, if we start going after the interests of the financial sector, if we start going after the private school system in this country, if we start going after the interests of landlords, for instance, in Britain, and we do it hard, as we saw with the Financial Times front page the other day, they will respond. And eventually Boris Johnson will have to respond on their behalf, because he, at the end of the day, is the leader of the Conservative Party. He's not the leader of some new force that's come from nowhere. And he represents constituencies that put him into power. And so he will be forced to represent deeply unpopular interests. And then we can realign the political system. And as I've just said, one of the great advantages of this moment, in my view, for the Labour Party and for socialists, is that the Tories have taken one of their great ideological weapons that they've used against the left for decades. I mean, I represent a magazine that's been around since 1937. If you go back and you read through all of those copies from the left of the Labour Party over decades, talking about what the Tories were saying about socialists, whether it be Nye Bevan or Michael Foot or Tony Ben or whomever, over the years, it was always the same. These wild socialists with their spending plans are going to tank the economy. They're going to cause a run on the pound. They're going to lead to capital flight. They're going to do whatever. Well, all of that can now be said about Boris Johnson and his no deal proposals. So we should take that on and we should run with it and say they've given up one of their great ideological weapons against us. So let's use it. We now can make far bolder policy proposals than we did in the 2017 manifesto. We can go so much further than we did 2 years ago in offering to transform people's lives. Yes, much more investment in the NHS, commitment to end privatization and new privatizations, but let's get more bold about the immediate end of all private interests in the NHS. Let's go back to some of the things that Nye Bevan was fighting for, an end to prescription charges and a genuinely decommodified health system where people know that from the moment that they enter into the moment they leave, it's free, it's public, it's universal. Let's do that for the education system as well, tackling the vestiges of privilege and wealth that have produced the likes of Boris Johnson and so much political power in this country. Let's take them apart. Let's take apart the network of private schools. Let's take apart the academy system. Let's return a genuinely democratic and public education system. Let's take them on with much bolder proposals about taxing the rich, much bolder proposals about nationalisation. We shouldn't be waiting in the rail for the franchises to expire before we take them back in. We shouldn't be saying, committing ourselves to a future of competitive tendering in the rail. We should go now and say we want a general public rail system under a single unitary body where we remove private interests and we have a public monopoly. And we should be going and fighting on all of these bases further than we did in the 2017 manifesto with more bold spending commitments. And we should put it up to the Tories and say, well, listen, every mainstream economist in the country already says you guys are planning to drive the economy off a cliff. You think you can turn that argument around on us now, and we're planning to improve the economic outlook for the vast majority of the people, and see then what they say with their populism. So that would be my proposal on how to take them on. I don't know that that's where the Labour Party is going. I think that a huge amount of institutional power is being leveraged now against Corbyn and the left leadership to force them to coalesce with the centre. And so we shall see.
Well, there's a scenario under which if they run the right kind of campaign that you've outlined, they could just use Boris Johnson as the perfect foil. Like, we are going to reinvent, democratize this economy, bring it up to speed for the 21st century, lift millions of people out of poverty, and also ensure that not only do we beat Boris Johnson this time, that there won't be another Boris Johnson created in this bizarre, incestuous wealth perpetuation cycle that global capitalism and British reactionary politics have created. So I hope they go that path.
Yeah, I agree. We shall see what happens in the coming weeks, because I do think a lot is going to be determined by how Labour Party responds to this no-deal controversy in the Parliament. At the moment, the party has turned down the opportunity for a general election, saying that it wants to wait until after Boris Johnson's proposal for a no-deal gets ruled out formally, at least until after the election, so that they would want, whether it be late October or early November, for the general election instead of his proposed date. But I do worry about that, because I think, you know, arguing that you want no deal ruled out or ruled off the court effectively in the Parliament, when the polls indicate that the polarization on this issue has created a huge constituency of popularity for no deal, a significant one, whether it be a third of the country or 45% or whichever poll you believe in. I think it does set him up nicely to say they don't want you to even be allowed to choose this. They don't want this option to be on the table. And, you know, this is one of those moments to be brave for the Labour Party and the left internationally, because the easy thing for us to do now is to yield to the column pages of The Guardian, right, and the sensible opinions of whichever moderate Labour MP appears on BBC News, and say, you know, we don't want them to demonise us. We want to, you know, be seen as respectable and sensible and whatever, and accepted as part of the political class. The hard thing to do is to treat this moment of history for what it is, which is a really unique threat of recent decades, of a resurgent right that is born out of a decade of economic stagnation, of deep dissatisfaction with the direction of society amongst the majority of people, which can't be overcome by simply returning to some status quo ante of a few years ago, but that has to be faced with a bold plan to make a new model of the economy, in which the, you know, working class interests, the majority interests, are reflected in a far greater extent than they are today. If we don't do that, if we're not bold at this moment in history, we will regret it, because even if in the next election in our various different countries, say for instance in Britain, although it won't happen here, but you can imagine very easily some pro-Remain centrist coalition in charge, the problem won't be, you know, winning one election in 2019. Right. The problem is, if they don't do anything to reshape the economy, then the election afterwards will produce something even worse than the right wing we're seeing today.
Absolutely. This is the same dynamic in the United States. I mean, this is another really key reason that we need to nominate Sanders, because frankly, you know, 4 years of look, you need to stop the crisis of Trump. You need to stop the crisis of all of these, I mean, very pernicious, disgusting leaders. But if you don't deal with the underlying conditions, then the underlying conditions will keep producing the same symptoms. Ronan Burtonshaw, editor of the Tribune in the UK, author of Only Corbynism Can Defeat Boris in the Jacobin. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Mike.
Thank you so much. All right, folks, we're going to go to the fun half in just a moment. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Bros. Become a patron of the Michael Brooks Show, where this Sunday's episode will be an illicit history of surveillance and the drone program with the co-director of the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College on Tuesday. Talking with Crystal Ball. Talked with Crystal Ball about why the establishment is lining up against Elizabeth Warren, what that says about the state of the race, and what Sanders really represents. Artesia Balthorpe and I talked about the water crisis in Newark on the postgame. We talked about the ecological implications of this fall's elections in Uruguay and made fun of Justin Trudeau and Andrew Yang and a whole bunch of other stuff. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Well on our way to first 3,000 patrons, and thank you for cracking 73,000 subscribers on YouTube as we power on to 100,000 subscribers. You could definitely get to the channel now. You get a good sense of the show. Matt, what's going on with Literary Hangover?
Ronan was with the Tribune in the UK. Mm. A little guy named George Orwell also wrote for them way back in the day. And so patrons can check out the last two George Orwell episodes. Did also coming up the second episode of James Fenimore Cooper's The Pioneers, which is about basically a fictionalized repossession of the history of James Fenimore Cooper's father settling Central New York. It's very interesting, book, so people want to check that out.
All right, dope. We'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Homo says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
What? What? What?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck, fuck, fuck.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on!
What?
Come on!
What?
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here!
I am a total
pussy. Pussy, 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 pussy.
Tittle.